It's being billed by Crystal Cruises as the ultimate expedition for the true explorer. It's the Crystal Serenity, the first passenger ship ever to take tourists through the fabled Northwest Passage. But here's what reporter Will Oramus wrote. It's a massive diesel-burning, waste-dumping, ice-destroying, golf-ball-smacking middle finger to what remains of the planet, courtesy of precisely 1,089 of its richest, most destructive inhabitants, and it's all made possible by runaway climate change. We're going to get to that, but meanwhile, Crystal Cruises CEO Edie Rodriguez says the cruise is environmentally friendly, and they've done everything possible to ensure they don't contribute to the problem. The ship left Alaska on August 16th, is expected to dock in New York next weekend. Michael Byers is a professor of international law at the University of British Columbia. He's been following all of this. And Michael, it may seem obvious, but why is the Northwest Passage now passable?
Well, the Northwest Passage is ice-free in late summer because of the effects of climate change. The Arctic has always existed in a fine balance between the frozen and the unfrozen. And so a change of just a degree or two can cause a dramatic diminishment of the Arctic sea ice cover.
Well, and for some people, just the phrase Northwest Passage conjures up this romantic notion of the most remote, the most unsettled, undeveloped place on Earth, huge area. But for others, you know, trying to think, wait, what is the Northwest Passage? Just briefly, what is it?
Well, the Northwest Passage is a series of straits and channels that pass between Canada's 19,000 Arctic islands, and it connects the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean as you continue through to Bering Strait and around the coast of Alaska. It was sought after by generations of explorers, hundreds of whom lost their lives, including Sir John Franklin, who very famously disappeared with his crew in the Northwest Passage in the mid-19th century. And the sea ice has historically kept most shipping away. But now that it's opening, it's almost a last frontier for tourism. And I can understand how people who've seen most of the rest of the world want to see polar bears, want to see icebergs, want to see bowhead whales, beluga whales. And so there is an attraction. And I was invited to join the first part of this cruise as a lecturer. I like to talk to people about climate change, like to talk to people about the indigenous peoples of the region, the challenges that we face. And so it was an opportunity. But at the same time, I'm looking at this ultra-luxurious cruise ship with an immensely large carbon footprint of its own, and 1,000 people who are drawn to the Arctic because they want to see it before it disappears in its current form. I simply didn't want to be part of that, that this was a form of extinction tourism, as very wealthy people go to places to see things before they disappear, and by going, actually contribute to that process.
But the Crystal Serenity is getting some credit for the safety precautions it's taking.
Crystal Cruises is probably the most expensive and therefore well-funded cruise company in the world, and it can afford to take all possible safety precautions. And they are voluntarily using low sulfur fuel that will reduce the impact in terms of particles of emissions that land on snow and ice and contribute to the melting. They have voluntarily chartered a support ship, British polar expedition ship, the Shackleton, to sail through the Northwest Passage alongside the cruise ship to provide a place of refuge in the event of an accident. I'm not worried about this particular cruise from a safety perspective. What I'm worried about is that it opens the door to dozens, possibly hundreds of other large cruise ships in the years to come. You know, if one thinks of the Costa Concordia, the large cruise ship that crashed onto the rocks of Italy a few years ago, causing significant loss of life. You know, accidents happen, and the Arctic is infinitely more dangerous than the coast of Italy.
Well, and you worry about the accident's impact on the Northwest Passage, but also the concern is about the impact on the passengers. Freezing temperatures, gale force winds, 20-foot waves. I can't even imagine them getting from one boat to the boat that's traveling with them. There might be a human disaster as well.
there could be a very significant loss of life, particularly if a cruise ship in the future did not have a support vessel, right. did not have a ship's helicopter like this one does. The nearest search and rescue helicopters in the Canadian Arctic are actually located more than 1,000 miles away. And even then, they could only take 30, maybe 40 people off of the ship per flight. So you start doing the numbers in a place with such extreme conditions, and this does become a very serious concern. Again, not so much for this particular voyage, but for the dozens and hundreds of other large cruise ships that will likely follow.
Well, and by the way, you mentioned you can understand how people might want to see polar bears. That's one of the concerns, that apparently these high-paying 1,000 or so passengers have demanded to see wildlife, and this is at a time when it's a very fragile time for things like polar bears.
Well, yes, and a ship this size and a ship's helicopter being used to view wildlife, all this does have an impact. A lot of Arctic wildlife is very sensitive to sound. Think of beluga whales, think of bowhead whales, think of narwhal. They communicate with sound themselves in the water. Or think about the risk of an oil spill. A large cruise ship like this has hundreds of thousands of gallons of fuel oil on board, and these are shallow, mostly uncharted waters. There's still ice in the water, glacial ice that is caused by climate change making the glaciers move more quickly into the sea, thus calving off more glaciers and creating more glacial ice, some of which is small and very difficult to spot.
Yeah. Well, then there's the danger to the Arctic. There's the danger to the Arctic animals. Some of them are just coming out of the winter. And then there's questions of the danger to the indigenous peoples.
Yes, and this is one of the ironies of this voyage. You have 1,000 of the wealthiest people on Earth descending on communities of some of the poorest, most disadvantaged people on Earth. They suffer from one of the highest suicide rates in the world. They suffer from endemic diseases like tuberculosis that are not common in developed countries, but here they are in northern Canada. They're under enormous pressure in terms of unemployment, in terms of housing. And then all of a sudden, 1,000 people who could, for all basic purposes, come from another planet descend upon them. And the gap between these two groups is so large that it's impossible to imagine a very positive outcome. Now, these indigenous peoples, many of them will tell you that they want to have this kind of cruise ship tourism because it brings some money to their communities. And they're right, it does bring some money. But the question is whether the social upheaval is worth that small benefit or whether there are better ways of bringing development to the Arctic.
Right. So you talk about the problems in these communities, the same problems that are in Native American communities, reservations in the U.S. Well, I can hear people saying, well, how come they're allowed to do this? And we've talked about this before in the program, the fact that there's been a longstanding gentle dispute about the Northwest Passage. Canada says it's their waters. The U.S. says it's their right of passage, but nobody's cared because, except for icebreakers, few ships could go through. What do you think is going to happen after this cruise ship? Do you think there will be regulations?
Well, you've identified it. There is a decades-long dispute between Canada and the United States over the legal status of the Northwest Passage and to what degree Canada can regulate foreign shipping like the Crystal Serenity. And for decades, we've been able to agree to disagree because these big ships could not come. The sea ice protected everyone by keeping the Northwest Passage closed off. It's opening now. The ships are coming. And obviously, we need better regulations. We need to make the use of low sulfur fuel mandatory. We need to have designated shipping lanes so that these ships not only avoid collisions with each other, but are also steered around sensitive ecological areas. We need a whole range of different improvements, and Canada will only feel comfortable in adopting such strong regulations if it has the support of the United States. And right now, it doesn't have the support of the United States. Instead, it has a legal dispute. So I call on both governments in Washington and Ottawa to sit down and to resolve this dispute and get to work addressing the real environmental and safety concerns that come with Arctic shipping, and ask themselves also whether it's in anyone's real interest to have these large cruise ships, these 1,000-plus passenger cruise ships, or whether a smaller form of ecotourism would in fact be better for everyone.
Yeah. Michael Byers, professor of international law at the University of British Columbia, on the sailing of the Crystal Serenity. We'll have pictures for you at hereandnow.org. Professor Byers, Michael, thank you.
Well, thank you for your interest. This is a story that the world needs to hear.
The world's wilderness areas are declining at a catastrophic rate. 10% of wilderness areas have disappeared in the last 20 years. That's according to a new study in the journal Current Biology, which compared current scientific maps with those from the 1990s and found more than 1 million square miles of wilderness around the world are no more. James Watson is the lead author of the study. He's with the Wildlife Conservation Society and is a professor at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, and he joins us via Skype right now from Brisbane. James, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And what qualifies as wilderness in your study? What are you talking about exactly?
So we look at all those areas on Earth that have no human footprint. And when we define that by is those areas that have no agriculture or no transformation to pasture land, no urbanization, no roads, or no large-scale industry such as logging or mining.
And are those the things that are cutting away at that wilderness, logging, mining, pasteurization?
It varies across Earth, but what we're seeing are, is that mining, in particular in Africa, agriculture and logging in the Amazon in South America are seriously eroding those wilderness areas. Agriculture also is a major player in changing wilderness areas in Asia.
Where is the change most significant around the world?
We've seen two areas which really have been dramatically transformed. The Amazon has lost 30% of its intact area in just 20 years, and Central Africa has also lost 15% of its wilderness areas in just 20 years.
And is this mainly in developing countries? I mean, those two places obviously are developing, but is that where the change is occurring most?
Yeah, look, it does vary from place to place, but even in places like Canada and Australia, we are losing our wilderness as well. But what we're seeing is those areas that were largely intact 25 years ago, often those countries which were developing, and they are losing their wilderness quite rapidly. Places that have already been developed have often lost all their wilderness already, so it's very hard to lose any more wilderness beyond that.
What about in the United States?
Look, there's a fair bit of wilderness being lost around the place, but what we're seeing is less dramatic than what we're seeing in other parts of the world.
Where is wilderness being preserved? Where is there not a problem right now?
Look, I think that's an excellent question. What we're seeing is wilderness loss just about everywhere. One of the major problems is that the United Nations Convention for Biological Diversity and the United Nations Framework for Climate Change don't really actively go out and protect these large intact places. And therefore, as a consequence, wherever we find wilderness, you're often seeing a state of decline. There is no real agenda in the global, international community or at the national level to go out and actually protect wilderness areas.
And how do you make the case that this is a major problem that people ought to pay attention to? Why does this matter to people who don't live in wilderness areas, people who live in cities around the world?
Look, I think there's a few points that people should remember around these large intact places. There's only 25% left on the planet that is largely unmodified by humans, and that's being eroded quickly. Now, these places are strongholds for biodiversity. They're critically important for carbon storage and sequestration, so they're incredibly important for the fight against climate change. But because of their nature as well, their functioning and the ecological processes are sustaining ecosystem services, they really do help millions of imperial people around the world. They give food and fiber and medicine to a lot of the most poorest people on the planet. So these wilderness areas are critically important for them as well. And I think finally, I think they serve as a reference point for humanity. These are the areas that are functioning without a human footprint on them. They're functioning the way nature meant them to function. They've evolved over hundreds of millions of years, and therefore they're a reference point that when we think about what nature should look like, or if we want to rewild nature in the future, these places are the reference points we need to refer to and say that's what nature used to be. And that's what we'd like to make other places look like again in the future.
So what can be done to slow the decline of the wilderness areas that are left in the world?
Well, I think the first step is what this paper is trying to do, and that's just raise awareness that there's a serious problem happening right now. This catastrophic loss, we're losing millions of square kilometres of wilderness over a period of just two decades. That's an area twice the size of Alaska, gone. if we don't stop that loss, we'll lose wilderness across the world forever in the next 50 to 100 years. So that's the first thing, is to recognize there's a major problem. I think the second thing then is that the international community should actually set targets to try and preserve their last intact systems around the world. Now, that means certain nations have to show leadership in that, and that's where the United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, these are countries which have got solid economies. They have large tracts of wilderness to actually say, you know, this, we're going to actually proactively protect these areas. And by doing that, setting the standard for other nations to follow.
That's James Watson with the Wildlife Conservation Society and the University of Queensland, joining us from Brisbane, Australia. And we'll link you to more about this study at our website, hereandnow.org. James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.